Welcome to another exciting episode of NID's Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. One of the reasons Real Space Strategy exists is to provide information to the public that it otherwise might not get, primarily related to how policy and strategy, as well as operational decisions, are made in national security space circles. There are scores of people writing about these topics, and some even commenting on news sources or books, some of which we've even had on this program. And sometimes, as we've done in the past, it's good to provide reality checks on some of what has been in the news as a service to you, our beloved listeners. And that is the focus of this episode. Recently, there have been many editorials regarding arms control in space, in particular from groups such as Plowshares, which publishes their Space Security Index and updates it every so many years. One editorial that was in Space News recently, about a couple weeks ago now, was a good example of these commentaries, and I wanted to read from it and provide some response commentary to the positions and thoughts in this editorial point by point. So I will provide the link to this in the episode summary for your reference if you want to read it yourself, but I'm going to be essentially reading the whole thing and then responding to every paragraph. So just to be sure everyone understands, though, I also want to mention this, is that this is about positions on policy and strategy. It has nothing to do with the authors themselves. So this is not anything personal. It's just an educational tool. So the editorial begins with this paragraph. It says, "Even as the community of nations on Earth fractures further into rival blocks, an effort to build greater cohesion in space is gathering momentum. The extent to which this succeeds or not may set the course of global peace and security for the foreseeable future," end quote. Reality check number one. There's no such thing as a community of nations. This is a phrase that's used quite a bit, primarily in global circles. And I will say there is multinational groups. There is international groups, such as the nation states may join or leave at their discretion, such as the United Nations, alliances like NATO, things of that sort. And she does mention the UN a few times in here. Even the international law documents, such as the UN Charter, state correctly that states, nation states, are still dominant players in the international system. And as such, there is no formally declared community of nations, legally speaking, or in real-world practice. Rival blocs that is mentioned in this editorial have been the norm, the normal situation in all of world history, especially since the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the Treaty of Westphalia, and even in the post-World War II UN system that we've been in. Examples, as I mentioned, NATO, Warsaw Pact, today would be NATO and the BRICS, the Quad, many others, and these are typically regional, the UN being the exception. So states are still supreme and politics still exists. Second reality check is there is no greater cohesion in space operations and space policy between the nation states, between the actors, the NGOs, things of that sort, as threats to war in space and the proliferation of weaponry are primarily due to specific nation states, Russia and China, that have over and over again refused to sign on to these agreements that groups like Plowshares are pushing. While it's nice to have the support of friends like Trinidad and Tobago or Liberia for such things, they have no real hard or soft power impact upon the Chinese and Russians to actively prevent or oppose their hostile actions in space or on Earth for that matter. One example that I believe was mentioned by one of my previous guests on a previous podcast was the International Court of Justice ruling regarding the Philippines versus the Chinese claims in the South China Sea. China really didn't care what those on the ICJ thought. The Chinese and Russians have a well-documented respect for and self-preference for hard power. As a result, until these nations agree to and abide by the rules, which, again, given their consistent messaging and behavior regarding the enforcement of sovereignty control and their growing capacity and use of hard power, is unlikely. It behooves nations like the U.S. and others to choose a side, preferably the side of freedom of movement in space, which is led by the U.S., and not the system of authoritarian vassalage, which is China. Second paragraph says, quote, diplomats, along with military, industry, civil and academic experts, are gathering in Geneva this week, which again was a few weeks ago now, for their annual Outer Space Security Conference hosted by the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research, or UNIDIR. Driving the agenda, how to build cooperation across the international community as it works to prevent an arms race in outer space, or PAROS. Now, reality check is, an arms race in outer space is already a reality. Just because the United States and some of its allies have not joined in the race fully does not mean that the race is not happening. China, one of the principal authors of the PAROS Treaty, has been reported in the open press and in unclassified Office of Director of National Intelligence reports, is rapidly developing, demonstrating, and deploying, and using, at the lower threshold at least, weapon systems in from into space. While diplomats have debated for years, possibly decades, what constitutes a space weapon, the reality is that space is a warfighting domain, and it has been for decades, at least in its recent incarnation since 2007. So it might be best to correct the terminology from prevention of an arms race in outer space to addressing the arms race in outer space. Given the fact that the organization hosting is designed to look at disarmament as a solution, it would make sense that they would correctly state their intentions. It is not prevention of an arms race, but rather the prevention of creating the weapons themselves, and by extension, denying the inherent right of nation states to self-defense against states that really clearly don't care what the UN and the so-called community of nations thinks. And this is something I might add that even the UN Charter guarantees to all member states, the right of self-defense. Now, the next paragraph. The timing of meeting is critical. Diplomatic efforts on PAROS have been on a rocket to nowhere for the past four decades, buffeted by competing aims. Some states want to ban weapons in space through a new legal agreement, while others are focused on anti-satellite capabilities that target space systems. This group sees a need for transparency and norms of behavior that support existing laws and prevent conflict, end quote. Reality check number one, timing of the meeting means little to nothing. The statement in this editorial afterwards highlights this, that PAROS has been going nowhere for three decades. Competing aims, as she calls it, are part of the normal behavior of states and should be understood if anything is to be accomplished in these meetings besides nice dinners and meaningless documents. Reality check number two is, given the threat is primarily seen by most as due to Chinese and Russian aggression, including active attacks upon U.S. critical space infrastructure, those of our allies and partners at the low threshold, as repeatedly stated by directors of the NRO and Space Force generals, not to mention the increasing kinetic space and space-to-ground weapon systems, even possibly a nuclear ASAT, shows that it might behoove these people to get beyond their idealism and try to understand who they are dealing with. Transparency, while nice-sounding, is something that is considered a weakness by the Chinese in particular. This is in business dealings as well as international, political, military, economic dealings. The idea that transparency will come willingly without something of value to them being traded is naivete and dangerous for the free nations of the world involved in this process. As for norms, while they're fine in and of themselves, I don't think there have been any norms, either customary or otherwise, that have prevented a war. In many cases, norms are seen as a tripwire to identify when a conflict begins and peace ends, or as the best practices for operations. Despite that viewpoint, it still doesn't prevent conflict from happening, and it's pretty simple and easy to tell when a conflict is happening. When your stuff is attacked, you're in a conflict, whether you choose to believe it or not. Next paragraph in the editorial, quote, as diplomacy has faltered, threats have risen. The Secure World Foundation's Global Counterspace Capabilities Report shows more countries developing technologies to harm or disrupt space systems. Trust in commitments to existing arms control measures is faltering. Outer space security was discussed at the United Nations Security Council for the first time ever this year in the wake of not one but two failed, I might add, I added that part, resolutions. These were initially prompted by concerns about potential development of nuclear weapons capabilities in orbit, which would violate one of the few existing international legal restrictions on the use of force in space, end quote. Reality check on this one. I would say that threats have risen, but not because diplomacy has faltered, but because nation states, China and Russia, have made the decision to pursue their rise in space power warfighting capabilities, as well as terrestrial capabilities, including invasion and harassment of other states. It is important to see space systems, quote unquote, not as this nebulous outside player that is being threatened by some nebulous weapons, but that just as aircraft and ships are flagged, and nation states are responsible for all space actions by the Outer Space Treaty, the issue should not be the tech itself, but the nation states' activities in space with that tech. I'm also pretty sure that space, quote, security has been discussed numerous times before at the United Nations Security Council, going back at least to 1967, when the whole treaty was being discussed about WMD in space. It is pointed out correctly in this editorial that these resolutions, one of which was just reaffirming current treaty law on WMD in orbit and on celestial bodies, failed because of, guess who? China and Russia. They wouldn't even vote to affirm something they already have affirmed and signed. So if you want transparency on the Chinese view, you have it there in that vote. They do not share the same concerns that some think that the non-existent community of nations supposedly already shares as the normal for space. It's not. Next paragraph, quote, efforts to repair the dangerous situation are also at risk. Two parallel UN open-ended working groups processes on Peiros are set to begin, one that would continue work on reducing space threats through a focus on norms of responsible behavior, and the other which would continue the work on elements of illegal agreement focused on barring weapons and the use of force in outer space, end quote. So, reality check. They're talking about repairing. It's never been unbroken. The arms activity and other technology movements have been the reality of things since the beginning of the space age in 1957. Space threats are not reduced by norms or banning weapons. Why? Because it never worked on Earth. See examples, the Hague and the Geneva Conventions, the Chemical Weapons Convention, and the treaty banning war as a viable political option. This does not mean diplomacy is a lost cause or something not worth pursuing, rather, but that the way forward in diplomacy should pursue something more realistic, and that means understanding the adversary's approach for success. While it does not hurt anything to discuss matters with adversaries, it might be more effective to address the specific issues, states as responsible players, and not weapons themselves. Next paragraph. But there is a glimmer of hope, too. I'm quoting here. A recent diplomatic victory charts a cautious path to success. In August, the UN Group of Government Experts on Further Practical Measures for Peiros adopted a consensus report outlining the scope of discussions and the varying views among states. In the field of outer space, where the extraordinary happens daily, this achievement may seem insignificant, but the content of the report offers threads of commonality across the two long competing approaches to space governance. Reality check, this, quote, victory is insignificant. A consensus report does not create a legal framework by which states are bound, legally or otherwise. Also, there is no enforcement mechanism currently active to ensure that any such legal framework is abided by. The UN Security Council is pretty much it from a global standpoint, but given two of the permanent five are parts of the problem, the major part, Chinese and Russians, getting anything rather through them is unlikely, at least for the foreseeable future. It would be better to build an alliance of UN member states that actually have the means and capabilities to shape norms of behavior through security-related operations and not agreements at the onset, at least. Make a statement, then proceed with a build-out of a defense infrastructure capable of protecting the interests of all space-faring nations via the protection of the interests of the major space powers. In other words, free world against authoritarian sides. And that, of course, as we saw earlier, is something that the author doesn't really like. Next, quote, a comprehensive approach to space security will require common understandings. The conference thus will lead to a consideration of the many threats and risks to space security, from the use of counter-space capabilities to natural hazards and gray zone activities that fall in between. A planned discussion on the existing governance framework is intended to flesh out the do's and don'ts of space that must inform any effort at additional rules and shed light on a core but elusive concept that informs the development of both norms and legal restrictions, the threshold of the use of force. Reality check. So as I've mentioned before in numerous episodes, there is a difference between, quote, space security and national security space. Given the author is from Plowshares, I think everybody should be familiar with their definition. The definition of space security reads, the secure and sustainable access to and use of space and freedom from space-based threats. Sounds simple enough. And if you didn't read the description and explanation, you might think it actually relates to national security. But this is what it says, their explanation paragraph. The key consideration in this approach to space security is not the interest of particular national or commercial entities, but the security and sustainability of outer space as an environment that can be used safely and responsibly by all. The definition encompasses the sustainability of the unique outer space environment, the physical and operational integrity of human-made objects and their ground stations, as well as security on Earth from threats and natural hazards. So in other words, so even though space security is used in Space Force doctrine, it is not about protecting critical space infrastructures that our nation, its allies and partners are reliant upon for everything. It's about securing the space environment, the sustainability of the environment. So it's protecting the environment of space itself. It's an environmental movement coupled with arms control, because they believe that a way to prevent debris is primarily through arms control. So the prevention of kinetic weapons, things of that sort, which is kind of odd, given the fact that that's not really what is the majority of debris created from. And we'll get to that here in a second. The final paragraph says, finally, neither the pursuit of legal agreements nor norms of behavior can bring success in the absence of verification and other measures to nurture confidence in their implementation. Expert input on the range of tools available to support transparency and confidence, as well as technical verification, is urgently needed. Now, one of the things I found interesting is the word nurture. And I have noticed that terminology that seems to come more from child development and behavioral theory than with strategy or geopolitics has been used a lot in the space security advocacy realm. And while strategic theory is a good tool for the assessment of adversary actions on Earth or in space, this must be focused on a strategic cultural understanding of the nation state that's creating the problems in the first place in order to develop the counter moves, or better yet, proactive moves to shift the advantage-disadvantage pendulum to the advantage side for the U.S. and away from the adversaries. Ideas from authors like this, which have become policy in the current administration and during some previous administrations, have led primarily to a self-deterrence posture for the United States and not much result from the Russians and Chinese. Now, again, as I started alluding to earlier, the main reason for debris generation is not anti-satellite weapons tests or use. It is Russian and Chinese upper stages and spacecraft continuing to explode because of non-passivation. In other words, they don't drain out the propellant in the tanks after deploying the satellite in the upper stage, or in the case of an old satellite that may be defunct and was not passivated or deorbited in time. And so with all the sunlight and darkness and the heat and the cold over and over again as it orbits the Earth, eventually that material inside weakens, and kablooey, you've got debris everywhere. By the way, I will mention that non-passivation and debris mitigation standards are something that the United States has been pushing since at least the 1990s, and that is something that's been pushed as a norm of behavior that clearly has not been adopted by everybody. So that's another example of some caution toward norms as the solution and not as a tool set. So this is just one example of an editorial on the one side of this discussion, and my reply, obviously. It's important to realize that many of the old space power schools of thought, such as Sanctuary, where a lot of folks on this side of thinking comes from, have been superseded by the space security thinking and arms control rather than the old arms control deterrence dichotomy of the last Cold War. And while the language may sound familiar, it is very, very different. So with that, that concludes this episode of Real Space Strategy. If you have any questions, feel free to find me on LinkedIn, and I'll be glad to answer your questions. And for now, this is Christopher Stone. Thanks very much for listening. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.